Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob KD2NBB will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering an audio stream. It's going to be a little wonky tonight, unfortunately, because of computer problems. You can get to it by typing stream.kc2rc.com. And usually, but not now, we have an Echo Link node available to use. Just point your Echo Link application to node kc2rc-r. The net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and all of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob KD2NBB will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experience to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or via our email, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob KD2NBB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. This is Bob KD2NBB. Hoping we have a nice net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, as do I, despite the computer problems. You know, you would think that I rebooted it 4 hours ago. Actually, 4 hours and 40 minutes, but apparently, sometimes boots don't take correctly. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if we have people out there with any questions or comments for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, Leo, you're about 60% noise, so please, if you could repeat your call sign a few times.
It's Theo, Kilo Delta 2, Zulu Kilo Delta, Kilo Delta 2, Zulu Kilo Delta, Kilo Delta 2, Zulu Kilo Delta.
Okay, Theo, I have you down. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight? Hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, very good. Well, Theo, you're up first. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
As I mentioned last month, I'm still screwing around with the dipole, and it seems to be working inside the house. I'm still tuning it. But I'm wondering if anyone has experience working with end isolators made of horn or bone.
Okay, that's an unusual question. So rather than use, I assume you're basically talking about the insulators at the end of antennas. In the old days, old-timers used to use old material. They kind of had two set of holes at right angles from each other, so if the insulator cracked and broke, although it would lose the insulating process, the two loops would lock into each other and the wire antenna wouldn't fall down. Nowadays, everyone's kind of shifted to different types of plastic. So I assume that when you're talking about using bone, you're interested in using bone as a very esoteric way of using it as an insulator. Is that what's going on?
Clearing out some equipment, and I realized I had some horns from my drumming days, and I realized, hey, they probably make good end insulators, and for the dipole, they're at the end, and they have a very low conductivity rating.
Okay, I mean, like I said before, it's very esoteric. 99.9 out of 100 people these days probably end up using some kind of a plastic insulator. Again, usually designed sort of in the same way that the old porcelains were. If you have them and you want to use them, I don't see any particular problem. I'd be curious, though, I guess it really depends upon the finish. If they're sealed, they should be fine. If they're not sealed and water gets into them, their insulating ability might be damaged temporarily.
Currently, I'm talking to you with plastic clips that are used in computer work, and they're rated for 48 volts, so they're fine. The horns I just found, I'm like, could these be used? It is esoteric. But, and at what point would I need to use them? 100 watts? 200 watts? What's the experience in here?
And should you comment, Roy?
Yes, sure, Howard. Comment.
Let me just lower the radio here so I don't get feedback. I was just trying out the audio stream, and I got a friend of mine that's trying to listen to the net online on the KECRC website. I'm only hearing, I'm not hearing your audio, Roy, just hearing the other station, the gentleman, as well as Bob, not hearing your audio coming through the audio stream.
I'm at AC2ZZ. Comment Alpha Charlie 2 Zulu Victor.
William recognized. Howard, at the very beginning of the net, the computer is acting a little weird and it's not really seemingly accepting my audio input, so I can't use it the way it usually works. And so I'm just going through the radio proper. The people, unfortunately, on Echolink and the people on the audio stream aren't going to hear my transmissions tonight.
Oh, I see. Very glitch, and you had to try to resolve it, but I guess not. All right, I'll be listening here. Just chatting on the phone with a friend of mine here. I was piping the audio actually through the old telephone line. So, all right, I'll be listening, and good evening to everyone on board. And CTOT.
Okay, well, I guess we'll go back to Theo. It sort of depends. I certainly would be a little bit worried if you were doing something like 1.5 kilowatts at the edges. I, for the most part, again, as long as the insulating qualities are half decent, I would assume you could easily go to 100 watts without too much worry. Again, you know, it's very esoteric, and the 99.99999 out of 100 would kind of say, well, I you know, it's an interesting idea, but I don't think anyone does it. So it's not that, you know, it's not like anyone in Brooklyn probably has any experience. I know old-timers who will give you endless stories about the old-time porcelain insulators. But Bo, other than on knife handles, I don't think many hams have really had much experience with that medium.
Thank you very much. And that's actually what I was looking for, was if you got any experience in this. I know my father had experience back in the 40s where people were in the Southwest and they were using animal parts for disciples. Like, that's kind of weird, but okay. I just happen to find them.
I understand. You use what you have, and, you know, I mean, a lot of earlier hams kind of used all kinds of things that they just had at hand. And if you go hunting, then I guess you're going to have a lot of bones as a resource. You could grind them down and make them as fertilizer, I guess, but you could also, I've seen ornamental use of bones, and I mentioned earlier knife handles are very commonly made out of bones and such, so why not insulators? So it's an interesting question, but, you know, in Brooklyn, where the only bones that any hunter might have are squirrel bones, it really doesn't come up much.
Okay, I've got another question. Do you have time for it?
Yeah, sure. I have all the time in the world.
You mentioned a strategy for winding the ends of the dipole. Currently, they're dangling. How would you suggest they be bundled? With tape or just trimmed or what?
Okay. Well, you know, it's important that the lengths be a particular length for your situation. The old standard from the ARRL handbook that goes back to the 1930s is 468 divided by frequency in megahertz. That's how you measure the half wave length of a half wave center-fed dipole. You know, it depends upon how close it is to the ground, how close it is to other conductors in the area, so different thing, and whether it's insulated or not insulated, so the resident might shift a little bit. Usually what you want to do is you want to build your dipoles to be a little bit longer than they have to, because it's a lot easier to shorten a dipole than to lengthen a dipole. Then what you do, usually, is you take the excess wire length and you wrap it around back onto the dipole. So effectively, the excess wire is seen by the antenna as a portion of the end wire of the dipole. You know, some people knot it. I don't really like the idea of knotting it. I think if you have copper and such that's nice and ductile, you could just keep wrapping it around, and then if you want to, you can secure it with a heat shrink tubing or some other insulating means to kind of keep it from unwinding itself. And if for whatever reason you feel that that's not the optimum resonant frequency for that dipole, it makes it relatively easy to unwind it, lengthen it a little bit if that's what you need, and then rewrap it at a longer length. So that's how I would suggest that you wrap it around an insulator of sorts, and you bring it back to the element, and then you just wind it with a tight wind, not too many, you know, you don't need excess feet of wire, so, you know, just a couple, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 inches, and then you secure it with either a piece of electrical tape or heat shrink tubing.
All right, thank you.
Comment AC2ZV.
That's William.
Hey, Roy, I'm thinking about the end, you know, and I'm just wondering how it's easy to adjust it and put the insulator on at the same time. So maybe I should think of having a messenger rope or something up there that goes the full length that I need to have it, and then have separate, you know, things at the end, you know, that hold the antenna in place. Do you think a messenger wire, then you could, like, tune it by folding it back and not have to reorient, you know, whatever rigging and such?
I don't know. I would probably have to see an illustration to get a good feel for it. Unfortunately, almost every time I've heard people talk about this, it's more of a manual situation. It's one of the inconveniences of antenna adjusting, in that, you know, there are some people who blissfully tune up the resonance of their antennas, all kinds of complicated things on the ground where they're not going to use it, and then they put it up on their roof or some elevation or someplace else, and then they're confused by their antenna not quite working the same way. So if you have a way where you can kind of switch the length of the end of the legs of the dipole, better power to you. But for the most part, what I've seen is just people mechanically taking it apart and rewrapping it. You don't have to secure it long term at the very beginning. Theoretically, you could do a very, very simple couple of turns to secure it, and when you finally decide on an optimum length, that's when you can go to the trouble of long-term securing it with, rolling up the rest of the extra wire and putting some electrical tape or heat shrink tubing.
What do you think about skipping the insulator altogether and just using a piece of parachute cord or nylon rope or something like that and loop it through the end of the loop on the dipole that you have to fold back, and then having that secured to the post? Why could you do that and not need the insulator?
Well, you're just trading one insulator for another. Theoretically, yeah, you could do it that way, and people do. They'll make a loop in the wire at the end, and they'll tie a loop of insulated guy rope, and they'll use that. You just have to make sure that the wire isn't going to unwind with stress. That's all.
Do you think sag has anything to do, you know, as the wire heats up or cools down into the sag will change over time? Should it be like one of my buddies upstate's got a pulley with a brick on the end of it that keeps his wire tight? Is that something that's important, is keeping it straight, or does it sagging make any difference?
You're never going to keep it perfectly straight. The laws of physics kind of require there to be some degree of a sag, and you want to make it as minimal as possible. And different people have different techniques. What's very common is people will put one end on a pulley system with either a spring at the bottom or a weight at the bottom, and so it'll kind of be to a certain range auto-correcting. If the spring breaks, if the weight drops off, you know, if the pulley gets jammed, there's a whole bunch of different ways for different mechanisms to fail. But certainly those types of stress adjusting mechanical devices have been used and will continue to be used, and is always a good idea. But you have to understand that each of them have their own limitations and their own problems and their own way of breaking.
I like your comment about having their own way of breaking. I think everything seems to have its own way of breaking. With this long wire, one of the things I'm thinking of is how actually I can check it and then make sure it's right. So if I'm thinking I need to get a network analyzer up on the roof when I install this thing to be able to make all the adjustments and stuff and have that work up on the roof and then put that into a 50-ohm cable, and hopefully by the time I get downstairs, those adjustments will stay. Do you think you can, that's the way to do it?
So that's a very good way of doing it. You know, it amounts to two different ways. One is a two-man operation, and one is a one-man operation. Two-man operation is someone's up top, the other guy's at the shack and has the VNA plugged in the shack. But you could do it as a one-man operation. If your coax cable is in good quality, it should have the same impedance going all the way down and shouldn't make much of any difference. So, yeah, you could just connect it locally near or at the feed point, hook it up for resonance, and then plug in the transmission line, and it should be similar down at the shack, making sure that the little things that you're doing, things that you should do, like you should always use a RF choke at the feed point for a center-fed dipole. Sometimes you can get away with it without having it, but other times you can't, and, you know, it's dependent upon the length of the transmission line in relation to the wavelength. So it's always a good practice. The reasoning that I like to give people is that the center-fed dipole is a balanced antenna, and a coaxial cable is an unbalanced transmission line. And in electrical circuits, you want to stay balanced to balance or unbalanced to unbalanced. If you have something that kind of transitions, you then need a balanced to unbalanced transformer or an RF choke. Otherwise, you'll get reflections of power, common mode currents, and you'll have a transmission line that's radiating sometimes more than the antenna is.
That's interesting about the RF choke. I thought you just needed a balun up, you know, at the center-fed dipole. I didn't think you could get away with just putting a choke. But maybe that would work. I'm looking at a commercial multiband antenna, and I think they have all this stuff built in. I don't know if I'd need an extra choke or not.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the antenna design is. Having an additional RF choke doesn't cause any problems, so there's no such thing as too many RF chokes. Usually, that isn't in the design of an antenna. If there's a need for a balun or an impedance transforming balun, that's sometimes included in the purchase of some antennas, but usually a one-to-one RF choke isn't. One guy I was talking about this very recently remarked that he's seen hundreds of articles on center-fed dipoles, and he doesn't remember one where they promoted one way or another putting in a RF choke near the antenna line. Although it's still important, and if you look at one of the more recent newsletters, I think I have an article that demonstrates what happens to a center-fed dipole if you don't put a RF choke near the feed line.
So, Roy, are you saying to take one of those ferrites and like clamp it around the outside of the coax the same way you would do with the AC power cord? Or are you saying to stick a transformer in some kind of one-to-one RF transformer that's similar to the hybrid that would be, you know, with a circular hybrid that would be doing the balun, but also secondary one-to-one-like balun behind it?
Okay. There's a bunch of different ways to accomplish this. As I said before, when you use a one-to-one balun, it's fundamentally just an RF choke. It may be designed a little bit different and have a balanced side and an unbalanced side, but what it's effectively doing is it's blocking common mode current from reflecting back into your transmission line. So near the feed point of a center-fed dipole, you can choose one of the following. You can choose a one-to-one balun. You can choose a row of about five or six hefty ferrite clamps one after the other. Usually people wrap that with some heat shrink tubing and then heat it up so that it seals and weatherproofs it. Or you could get a ferrite toroid, basically a glorified donut, and you can run your coax cable loops around it, six or seven loops if the toroid is big enough. And all of those will give you impedance that produces an RF choke. Also, you could do something that's called an ugly ballon, which is really just a coiled-up coaxial cable with an air core. Some people like it. Some people don't like it. A lot of electrical engineer types don't like it because they've measured the amount of impedance that an air core inductive coil produces, and it's inferior to those produced when you're wrapping it around a ferrite toroid. So they prefer the ferrite toroid to the air core. But there are people out there who will recommend to you a ugly ballon, which is really just an air core a coil of coax working as an inductor that adds impedance for common mode currents.
So the question I have is you still need a lightning protector gas tube arrestor down in the shack as well as that, or does that actually prevent the lightning from wanting to go there because of the, you know, the all the coils?
AC2GS. No, unfortunately, RF chokes will have no effect on as lightning arresters. I think most people, unfortunately, don't have lightning arresters on their antenna, and they are able to get away with it. You know, if you're living in a metropolitan environment, most buildings are taller than you, your antennas aren't that high, and so the risks of lightning strikes to your antenna are not quite as great as if you lived in the more rural areas or on a hill and, you know, places like that. But the bottom line is an RF choke will not help you prevent lightning strikes.
The question I have is it better to have, like, a patch panel, or it can be set up with switches so that you can put the VNA online, and then you can put this radio or that radio online, and then also have the ability to have, you know, sensitive equipment receivers online, but then have them protected from transmission. So there's an extra switch. It seems like there's a lot of contraption down in the shack that I need to think about.
Well, people have different philosophies. I have switches, and theoretically, during times of lightning, I switch them to the ground position, so the center line is grounded. A lot of people don't. There are a few people who are even more paranoid than I am. They will unscrew their coax cables that are connected to antennas, and, you know, terminate the edges in some weatherproof type and just dangle them out the window so they're not introduced into the shack. Again, I think most people just leave them connected all year long because the lightning threat in places like Brooklyn and Queens is rather minimal.
So if you have a VNA, is it okay to switch it on and offline and, like, in front of the antenna tuner, to, like, put it on and then tune up the antenna through the antenna tuner and then put the radio on like that? Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I kind of swore we talked about that before. Although you could theoretically do that, I know no one who does that. Simply because almost all antenna tuners have a built-in SWR meter, and you already have, hopefully, a transmitter that's going to supply more than the millivolts of power that a VNA puts out. So in most practices I'm aware of, People tune up their antenna with the VNA, then they put the VNA in the drawer someplace, and from that point on, they tune up the antenna tuner using their transmitter as their output source, and the SWR meter built into almost every antenna tuner to make the fine adjustments.
Yeah, now I understand the problem. At this point, my problem is that I got this 3kW tuner, and it's just, you know, it the meters are totally out of range. So I think I probably ought to get a meter that would actually read lower powers, because I don't think this unit I have is going to put out more than 100 watts, and this is a 3kW machine. So the meters are just not, they don't budge very much.
They don't have adjustable power settings. Most of these things tend to be able to be shifted from, 20 watts to 200 watts to 2,000 watts. You know, almost all the meters that I have range adjustment settings. And they just introduce a different resistance into the circuit. So I'm willing to bet if you look around, unless it's a very strange antenna tuner, it must be able to read smaller powers, because not everyone is using legal limit, even though it's capable of it. Most designs that I've seen in the past are able to be used under lower power circumstances. I could be wrong for your specific model, but I'm just going with the average one that I'm aware of.
The lowest setting on this is 200 watts, so I don't think it does very much. It seems to me like I better figure out how to cut the resistor out and change it, or divide it in half or something, make it more sensitive, because I don't think I could budge the 200 watt meter at all, with this radio.
Okay, that's rather strange. Another option is to simply buy another meter that reads the SWR, and make sure that you're putting it in the right place. You have to understand that you are not supposed to put an SWR meter between your antenna tuner and your antenna, because it will not read any difference no matter what you do with the antenna tuner. There's a place to put a separate, unique SWR meter would be past the antenna tuner itself on the way to your transmitter.
So it goes transmitter, SWR meter, tuner, whatever. Then that's the way to set it up, right?
Yes. If you do it the other way, it's just going to tell you what the uncorrected SWR of your antenna transmission line is. It will not be affected by any changes you make in the antenna tuner, and so its benefit would be marginal at best.
Okay, I guess that's what I was getting at by having the ZNA switchable in and out kind of thing. So the more important thing is to get a proper antenna tuner. This unit has an external box with two UHF type connectors on it that actually are for the meter. You're supposed to run the power through this little box that has some resistors and stuff in, and then it goes to a cable inside that runs the meters. So I don't think that these meters are going to work that well. So I think, especially where it's mounted and everything, I'd be better off getting a good separate SWR meter as part of my setup.
Yes, I would agree. An SWR meter is one of those purchases that inevitably you will be using a lot of. Although I would suggest that, I'm sure you have a voltometer. There are a lot of hams that don't even have a voltometer. And although, I despair of the future of the hobby under those circumstances, I could understand in some situations, some hams don't really need a voltometer to do whatever they're doing. But certainly an SWR meter comes in very handy. They come in different ranges. They come in digital. They come in analog. They come in small sizes. They come in enormous sizes. So if you want to see the numbers from across the room, in some cases you can do that. So it's always good to have, you know, one, at least one, if not more than one, SWR meter around. They come in very useful.
I there's a difference between the detector part and the display part, but I definitely think that it would be good to have one on maybe each antenna. So the other question I want to ask is that if you're going to be transmitting on a band, are you able to actually monitor your transmission on another antenna that's nearby, or does that have to be really far away?
It doesn't have to be very far away, but it has to be somewhat far away. You're going to be desensing your receiver with the transmitted signal that you're putting out, which is going to make it very difficult. Even in cases that, you know, there are people who monitor their UHF or VHF transmissions. They'll transmit on one radio. They'll listen for their signal on the other. So if they time out the repeaters, or the repeater fails, or someone's interfering, or someone's trying to break in, they can hear it and respond accordingly. And in those cases, you usually need to have the two antennas relatively wide apart in your property lines, because if they're sitting, you know, 6 feet or 10 feet away from each other, even though they probably will not blow out the front end of the receiver, you know, they won't get quite enough RF power to blow it up, at the very least it will desense the receiver's sensitivity, and so you won't be able to appreciate the signal. It'll be mostly noise.
Yeah, I think all I've got is 20 feet between either side of the property. So I don't know. It's a long wire that's like 60, 70 feet long. I don't know if I can put up two, one on either side of the property, 20 feet apart. And then, you know, it would be more like 16 feet apart, actually. But, and then have one be able to receive only, and the other would be transmit-receive.
It wouldn't be sufficient for your purposes. What sometimes people do with multiple antennas is that they will, you can combine two antenna signals in interesting ways to decrease the background noise sometimes. MFJ sells a phase adjusting device where it accepts two antennas for receiving and will take one signal, invert it, and use it to lessen the background local noise in the environment. But as purely a way of listening to your own transmissions, in HF that's really not done. What some people do is they'll use services like WebSDR. So there are people out there who have a SDR hooked up to a computer, hooked up to the internet, and you log into that, set it to the frequency that you're transmitting, and if all goes well, you can hear your signal after a latency delay from those WebSDR devices.
If it turns out you have a bunch of junk in the line that's like a TR switch that's going to protect the receiver group, and then you got a lightning protector, and then you have an SWR meter, and then you have the transmitter, like, what is the best organization for how that should be, plus an extra switch for test access for the VNA for occasional access? What's the best organization for that?
Well, attenuation losses from switches should not be great. There's a fallacy often heard on YouTubes that you know, if you hook up a five or six or seven UHF connectors, one on top of another, you know, 3/4 or 9/10 of the signal will be burnt up in the connectors. If the connectors are of good quality, there's next to no decrease. You know, the SWR meter might introduce a slight decrease, but, you know, whether you hook them in one way or the other, their attenuation loss will be identical. The SWR meter has to be between the antenna tuner and your transmitter, so you have no choice. The switches you can put anywhere that it's convenient for you for the sake of what you want to switch. And the lightning arrester, you should try and keep that out of your shack. So that should be done before the transmission line gets into your shack.
Is best done outside on the building entry, and then we go from there inside.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's what I had in mind, and I'm thinking that I'm going to put a box outside with a feed-through tube and stuff, and I get XYL problems on that, but I think I'm going to get through it. Anyway, thanks a lot, Roy. I really appreciate it. I've had some nice installations over the years where I've had, like, thousands of dollars to spend, and I've got to now do it on tens of dollars, so it's a real different experience.
Yes, it's usually easier to do these things on someone else's dime.
Especially when they really want it badly. Yeah, that's the best part. You know, it's really fun to be able to build things, you know, for somebody who really wants it right now. And I've had a lot of fun with that in my career.
Okay, so now you have different limitations, and I'm sure you'll figure out solutions for those as well.
Oh, okay, Roy. You know, I haven't checked the puzzle tonight. I don't know what's going on. I'll have to check it. Maybe there's some late check-ins.
Okay, I'll give it a try. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We go on until people run out of questions or comments or topics to discuss. So if you're out there listening to me, you have a question or a topic or a comment to make about, you know, something I said, yeah, you might disagree with me, I feel free. Hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Good evening, Roy. This is Maxim, KG2VEA.
Max.
How are you doing today? Just a call and follow-up. Earlier you had a discussion about RF chokes on antennas, and just wanted to clarify. So I built two. One is a dipole, and this connected for, I think, one-to-one balance, so that sounds like it's fine. But then I built another one, which is an end-fed, and that has, obviously, a toroid inside, but does that need an RF choke on a coaxial?
It depends. Also, it depends on what kind of an end-fed that you made. Did you make a half-wave end-fed that has either a 64-to-1 or a 49-to-1 balun, or did you make what's usually called either a non-resonant or a random end-fed that usually has something like a 9-to-1 balun?
Quarter-wave, 49-to-1.
Okay, theoretically, you might be able to get away without an RF choke. It sort of depends upon if you have RF in your shack. I'm not right, quite sure why. Did you really do a quarter wave with a 49-to-1 end-fed?
Maybe it's a halfway. I gotta look it up. Maybe it's a halfway. It was the kit from ARRL that I bought for. A while ago, and it has multiple. The wire, I can cut it to whatever I want, but basically it could be a 10, 20, 40, 80, and with some special things that I can do to it, it could be 160.
Okay, so it's really a halfway, because the impedances of a quarter wave are nowhere near the 2 or 3,000. thousand ohms that a half wave does, and that's why you need a 49-to-1 transforming baron to get anywhere with a half wave as opposed to a quarter wave. A quarter wave is just one half of a quarter wave ground plane vertical that should have an impedance of about 40-50 ohms, so you wouldn't need any kind of a baron that powerful transforming things. So I mean, basically, like I said, you might be able to get away with it. It's probably a good idea to put it in before your shack so that it limits the amount of RF getting down your transmission line into your shack because, you know, computers are very sensitive to RF. You might get away with RF being in your shack as far as radio equipment is if it's well-designed and well-shielded, although you might have problems with things like microphone inputs and such, it's always good to throw in an RF choke, something adequate for the frequency that you're planning to use it on.
Okay, that's interesting. So one day I'm still hoping you'll get to look at the antennas and tell me if they actually work.
Okay, I look forward to it. Of course, you know, you could do a VNA sweep. Nano VNA is going for about $80, and it gives you a very nice illustration. You could share it with other people. If you don't understand what's going on with portions of it, you can send it to each other, and you can get a lot more information that way. So I'm a big fan of VNAs. Before I had a license, those things sold for tens and twenties of thousands of dollars and weighed a ton. Nowadays, you could put one in your pocket for less than $80. So keep it in mind.
I actually do have a VMA, and the dipole I detest and seem to have VNA said it was working well, but when I tried using it, didn't really have good results. Maybe I'm using the VNA wrong. Maybe I'm doing something else wrong. But getting somebody to look at it who is actually knows what they're doing will probably be far better than the VNA.
Okay, I mean it's not 100% sure proof. What a VNA will tell you is whether the impedances are correct. Unfortunately, they will not tell you about the efficiency of antennas. We've talked about it here. I've talked about it on LIMARC, that if we had an ability to actually calculate antenna efficiencies, we would know a great deal more about our antenna and probably be a great deal more depressed about it. I give you as an example one of the rare cases where someone actually took the trouble of measuring efficiencies, at least approximately. Some guy somewhere at some place was kind of tired of people promoting these ham sticks. They sell a ham stick, I believe, for 160 meters. So it's a big coil and a short vertical whip, and you hook it to your fender. And if you have a 160-meter transmitter, you transmit and you listen and you hear the world. The guy kind of sat there and measured things, and he figured out that the efficiency of that antenna, the way it was designed and used, was less than 1%. And, that's the problem with efficiencies. Your antenna might be a perfect impedance match, but then so is a dummy load. And it doesn't really travel that far. So there's more to an antenna, unfortunately, than impedances. Some we could measure, but a lot we can't.
Very true. Very true. But you gave me something to think about in terms of potentially RF chokes. I did add some equipment around the house just in case, but it will be interesting to see. And speaking of SWM meters, I got one from JetRow or JetLab or something like that. Seems to be working on the other 10-meter radio that I have. It does seem to be, even though it was exposed to the radio transmitting 100 watts, it does seem only to be jumping 80 or 70, so surprising there.
I'm not getting any audio. I'm just getting the repeater keyed and then it unkeys.
Roy, your last few transmissions were on Fusion. You were transmitting using Fusion and TGOT.
Okay, that's very, very weird. I wonder why that did that. It's not supposed to do that. I said it so that nothing's going to switch it out of FM. Anyway, I assume, Max, that my last comment didn't reach you.
Nope, but I can hear you now. I was wondering what happened. I was kind of hoping the repeater didn't die. That would be a very sad day.
I don't know what caused it. Usually AMS is supposed to switch to digital when it hears a digital signal, so I guess my radio misinterpreted some response from the repeater that it was digital and went there. So it's not going to do that now. I don't remember exactly what I was answering, so if you want to ask the question again, I'll try again.
I think we were settled on the questions that I had. Now I'm just curious to see what the puzzler is for tonight.
Okay, I will probably get to it real soon. I'll ask if anyone has any other questions for tonight, because that takes precedent. But there's no other questions, then we'll move on to the puzzler. So anyone out there, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. until we run out of steam. So if you're out there and you're hearing me and you have a question or a comment to make about, you know, something I said, if you disagree with it or you want to add to it, then feel free, hit that push-to-talk button.
KD2NVB, I actually have a little question about a weird thing on my 7100. Back to you.
Very good. Tell us about the weird thing on your 7100.
Yeah, lately, the clock that tells you what time it is, it just keeps going whacked out. A couple of times I, you know, set it properly, and it's not just that it suddenly goes to the wrong time zone. It'll just say something completely different than what the time is, even though I haven't set it recently now. I just kind of gave up on it. Is there a battery or something that's supposed to store the time? But I think that's our capacitor. I don't know. But it's just wacky. And I haven't really explored it deeply. I just noticed that it's just gotten weird lately. Any ideas?
Really? I assume that there's no really good power backup supply. When I cut the power to it, it kind of resets itself. You know, right now it thinks it's 2202, which it obviously ain't. So, I never really used the clock for that reason, because it was so incredibly undependable, and it goes to, apparently, it might be able to sync, but it doesn't know out of the box what time zone to sync it to, so it just kind of does whatever it feels like doing.
Well, there are settings for, like, time zone and whether you want to show UTC or your time zone, and you tell what it is. And in the past, it worked. I mean, it was not the most accurate clock. I can't remember. I think it either rushed or dragged. I can't remember now. But actually, right now, it's showing the right minute, which means it just flipped the time zone. But I've had other times where I swear what even the minute was way off. So I'll have to look more into it.
I would assume that there is either just a capacitor that holds a charge, or a little silver, watch battery that, since this thing is 10 years old, it probably doesn't work anymore. And that's one of the reasons why, when the power goes out, it just randomly does strange things.
Yeah, mine's only 5.5 years old, but anyway, back to you. Yeah, I'll have to look more into it.
Yeah, let me know, because, if it's a simple thing, that would be nice. I realize that there are settings for time zones. It's just that in the past, I got the sense that if I cut power to the unit, it kind of forgot what I set it to, and it wasn't worth my trouble to go through the menus to get everything to be set correctly, because inevitably I'd have to turn it off and on again, and then I'd have to start from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, it's supposed to preserve the time. I know it used to. Like I said, it wasn't the most accurate, but it was, you know, maybe just off by a couple minutes or whatever. But obviously, it'd be pretty useless if every time you shut the power off, it wasn't designed that way. Something went wrong, I guess. Right now, it's reading like 3 hours fast. It says 058 instead of 958, so I guess it's thinking it's almost 1 o'clock in the morning. Somehow, anyway, whatever.
Yeah, I assume the primary, well, there's two problems with it, that the clock is not based on anything that's very, very accurate, and so there's drift that exists. I have to unpower it and power it back. It just kind of resets to something or other, or syncs with something or other. I don't know what it does. And I think the problem is it kind of loses what we set it as the time zone and randomly selects its own. So, you know, my time zone obviously is different than your time zone by 3 hours.
So one of us is either in California, or I guess in my case, my radio thinks I'm halfway between here and Great Britain or something, and somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. Back to you.
Well, I don't know. Curious these things are. But all things being equal, I love my ICOM 7100. It's my go-to for all that I do with LimeArc. It feeds the audio stream, and it's the one that I use on Sunday nights there.
Oh, yeah, I love this radio, too. I wish I had a way to get a good HF antenna on it, but yeah, I love this radio, and it fits my little lack of space the way I use it. It's like the only radio I know that could. Back to you. Yes, I really like this radio.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of radios that have detachable heads, because I can put the main body to my left side. I have an old television rack that has all my big equipment, and the heads go circling around at the edge of my desk. So I have my ICOM's head, 7100 head on one side. I have the FDM 400 in the middle. And of course, the Flex, the head is really my computer screens.
Right, and you couldn't have put three whole radios in that space, obviously. Yeah, same here. I just have this little computer desk thing that just was supposed to hold a keyboard, and they put a mouse or something on the right of it or whatever, and I could stick the little head from the 7100 behind the trackpad, and it works. It's great. And then the main unit is just, you know, about a foot back, where I don't have to be able to reach over and deal with it, so it's great.
Yeah, it's great when a design kind of clicks and works. And actually, I don't have three radios heads. I have four, because I also have a Kinect Systems CS800 that when I was interested vaguely in DMR, I would do my DMR using that. And that head sits right below the FDM 400's head. So it's four radio controls on my desk, and most of the electronics is sitting to the left of me, stacked in a TV cart.
And AC2ZV.
William. Yes, William.
Do you have all those radios on the same antenna? Do you have different antennas, or do you patch them as you need?
In the old days, it was a combination of both. What I would have done is switch in and switch out an antenna when I was doing DMR. I have an antenna that's dedicated to the 7100. I have an antenna that's dedicated to the FDM 400. And my HF antenna goes into my Flex.
antennas that are independent of one another.
If you don't do that, then you can't really transmit. I've had times where I do have splitters so that I could theoretically connect three different radios to receive from the same antenna. But if you forget and you hit the transmitter button, you burn out the splitter.
I was wondering about that, so that you have a TR switch in front of the splitter, right? I mean, you know, before the transmitter part.
I don't. I just have my brain that says, do not do that, foolish man. And if I decide that I want to legitimately transmit, I have all these things basically having BNC connectors. So it makes it much easier for me to reconfigure what goes where rather than unscrewing the, you know, the screws of a UHF connector.
In the TV work that I came from, we used to use these sleeve jacks that for, you know, SDI that were 75 ohm, but, you know, you could patch in and out with patch cords and stuff like that. And, you know, they went up to like a gigahertz or something like that. Did the ham radios have a 50 ohm version of that sliding patch jack?
BNCs come as either BNCs come as either 50 ohm impedance connectors or 75 ohm impedance connectors. You just have to order the right set.
I'm talking about these WECO patches, which is a sliding patch jack, so that you have like looping plugs and stuff like that. Like we used to have IF at about 70 megahertz. And we had all these patch panels and stuff for the IF splitters and dividers and looping plugs, you know, within the radio shacks and stuff like that that we built. I was wondering if ham radio has uses like the sleeve jacks or if you know what they are.
They, as far as I'm aware, they don't. Those are way too expensive for cheap hams like us. Like I said, I mean, there are patch bays and all kinds of things that people jury-rig and such, but to me, the easiest approach is to have BNC converters on these things, and so I just kind of reconfigure them, and it takes no time at all. You know, you can get a handful of BNC connectors for a couple of bucks. I assume that the devices you're talking about are commercial in design and cost significantly more.
You're right about that, but you know, on occasion, I mean, in different things, we use different ideas. So, I you know, the bulkhead jacks are great. So you can get BNC bulkheads. I think that's what I'm going to use in my design. They're relatively cheap. You can drill holes out of aluminum, and then you can make a nice patch panel with looping plugs and everything. So I don't think that would mess up the impedance too much if it was done well. What do you think?
It sort of really depends on what you're modifying and how close it is to the conductors and the insulating portion of the BNC connector, because that's what ultimately determines the impedances. And unfortunately, as I'm sure people will tell you in the future if they haven't told you in the past, UHF connectors do not have a nominal impedance of 50 ohms. N connectors do. N connectors are much more strictly designed so that there's no impedance mismatch. So I think that the average UHF connector has an actual impedance of about 35 ohms. The fact is that since it's such a small amount of length, it doesn't really impact the transmission line's ability to transfer energy. But, you know, some connectors are not really designed to be the specific impedance that they should be.
Yeah, I know about that. I mean, in the TV business, we used to have these 75-ohm type N connectors, and if you plug them in the wrong way, like into a 50-ohm, they wouldn't make contact, and if you plug them in the other way, they would break the connector. you plug a 50 ohm male into a 75 ohm female, it just breaks the connector. So I don't know. I haven't done much 50 ohm work, and mostly everything I did was playing with 75. But the BNCs are familiar. I like that as a plan because I don't like unscrewing and screwing in. I think that is too much time.
I've gotten a lot of use out of BNC connectors when it comes to handy talkies. The first thing that I do with a new handy talkie is I get a converter. Usually it's a SMA connector, so SMA to bayonet, and then I only buy antennas, handy talkie antennas that have bayonet mounts. So it's much easier, much less likely to come loose, much less likely to have mechanical forces snap it in half. So all my handy talkies have little adapters on them, and they all feed into BNC-based antennas.
Do you call that a bayonet nut adapter or a British naval connector? What is your take on that?
Ultimately, six of one, half a dozen of the other. The BNC stands for British Naval Connector. Most people don't know them as that because most people use the initial. So almost all the time, I just call it a BNC.
You know, we also use TNCs, which are threaded nut connectors. And it seemed to me that the British Navy was just overstepping their rank a bit there.
Well, again, you know, what's in a name, as Shakespeare said. So 99.9% of AMs are going to, probably more than that, are going to call them just BNCs. The curious thing about BNCs, you mentioned the interesting design of the end connectors, that they were not compatible. Problem, unfortunately, when they originally designed the BNC is they didn't design that type of a feature into them. So it's very easy to screw a 75 ohm impedance BNC to a 50 ohm BNC connector.
Well, that's fine, and there's really no damage when you plug the 75 into the 50. But if you're doing good VISWAR testing at 75, you have to have the kind where they've taken all the phenolic, or I call it coconut, out of the middle of the connector. So there's just a center pin with no phenolic around it in the 75 ohm version, but the 50 ohm version has got phenolic on both the male and the female. And so you get better VISWAR with no coconut, but that's only when you're doing HDTV and you're trying to get 3G to go through coax.
Yeah, in a perfect world, you want a constant uniform impedance, and one of the factors that affect the connector's impedance is the type of dielectric, phenolic versus just air, because even air is a dielectric, just has a different dielectric constant.
Somehow we figured it out for BNCs, but not for not for the type N, so... You know, I always had so much fun with all this stuff in my earlier years, and now I get to have fun with the ham radio side. So are we going to do the TechNet puzzle soon, Roy?
I would assume so. I mean, thankfully, I keep asking if anyone has any comments or questions, and they do. But, you know, eventually that, too, will run out. So I'll try it one more time. I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy. And this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net that's here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month, starting at 9 p.m. So if you're out there and you heard me and you have a question or you have a comment about something that we've been talking about, then please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
2GS, this is Kate. A-H-H, Michael.
Michael!
I have been on here before, actually. I'm now using my mag mount on the cookie sheet, like you advised me to, and it has a pretty good SWR. I just had a quick question about what you guys were just talking about.
Michael, your signal is nice and strong. You got a little bit of noise in the background, but very readable.
Noise is a heater. I just shut it off. Actually, it takes 30 seconds to shut, so it'll be gone momentarily. Oh, there it goes. So my question was, the fellow before was talking about the coconut, the white, like that white insulator in the coax. I've been noticing screwing in all my antennas back and forth and everything. I'm not sure if it came from that, but maybe it's like grinding a little bit of metal and there's like a little bit of metallic shininess on the coconut. Will that affect anything at all?
I can't tell you exactly what's going on. The so-called coconut is basically just insulator material, or fancier term is dielectric. And so what determines the characteristics of a given coaxial cable and a connector is the diameters of the conductors and the type and thickness of the dielectric insulating material. As long as structurally everything is reasonably close to the way it's supposed to be, it should not be a terrible problem. Ultimately, I guess it's possible to grind away the insulator, and that can change impedances, which isn't going to be that much of a problem, but it could lay wire bare for possible shorting, which would be problematic. So, you know, a visual inspection every so often, but I wouldn't be unduly concerned.
I guess that was it. I just had that question. I heard you guys talking about it. That it's the perfect time to jump in.
Sure, you're welcome anytime. Any other questions or comments for tonight, Michael?
None for now. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good, Michael. Thanks for participating. I hope you'll join us again in future versions of this technical net. Okay, let's go to the puzzle. A relatively simple puzzle. The question is, an amplifier used as a switch operates in which class? And you have a choice of four different amplifier classes. Hopefully you all remember what each class is. I think it was a question either on the tech or the general. The choices are A, AB, B, and C. So anyone want to hazard a guess of which amplifier would be best used as a switch? Come on, it's one out of four, you know? I mean, take a guess.
B2CV.
William?
I'll go with D.
Very good. You are absolutely positively correct, William. The way that amplifier classes work is what portion of the total input signal the amplifier amplifies. In the case of a Class A, it's amplifying the entire signal. So there's no point where the amplifier stops doing amplification. In B, it's 50% on and 50% off. So it's almost like it was an amplified rectifier. So when it's going in one direction, it amplifies, but when the signal is going in the opposite, it doesn't do anything. AB is a mixture between the two, where it's not going for the whole 360 degrees of the signal, but it's going more than 180 degrees. And C is where it's going less than 180 degrees, or it's not amplifying the entire one half of the signal. It's amplifying some portion less than one half. So in that case, it's highly efficient, but full of harmonics that have to be dealt with, but it makes for a very good switch operation amplifier. So the answer for this question was D, and William is correct. Any questions or comments?
C2ZV.
William? Yes, William?
Okay, well, I had a question about that AB. Seems to me if one half clipped and the other half, you know, clipped every other cycle, every other half cycle, it would actually not be, you know, that good because it would be full of harmonics. So what about that? It doesn't seem that useful. I can see B, but AB, unless it's something to massage the crossover, I just don't see the point of it.
It's a matter of how much filtration you want to deal with. They all kind of get more efficient. B is more efficient than AB. AB is more efficient than A. A requires negligible filtering. AB requires some filtering. B requires a lot of filtering. And C requires a heck of a lot of filtering. So you pay one way or the other. You either pay in efficiency or you pay in the problems of engineering the proper filters to get the signal out in the way that you need it to be.
I see. So the AB does create higher harmonic frequencies and stuff like that, but you have to filter them out of the signal, and then you can get a more pure sine wave or your fundamental that you want to get more pure out of the way the arrangement works out.
And you improve the efficiency of the design over a Class A amplifier, which is very inefficient.
So it's like the rails, like plus 12 to minus 5 and plus 5 to minus 12 or something like that? Is that how that kind of works out for the AB?
That would be one example. There's no particular setting. It's just it's someplace between a Class A and Class B. Where on that spectrum depends upon the people designing that particular AB amplifier.
Interesting. I looked this up online, and I didn't see the comments about the filters. I mean, they showed about how the transistors were hooked together in the various classes of amplifiers, but they didn't talk about the filters after the hookup, which I think is an interesting missed point.
A lot of times people are very specific in their answers, and it sort of goes back to what I said earlier, the gentleman I was talking to about the fact that using a transmission line for a center-fed dipole really requires either a one-to-one balun or an RF choke, and his response was that most articles, if you look up articles on dipoles, they don't go into that at all because they're focusing on the antenna and not really the transmission line and the effect that the transmission line has on the antenna. So in the same way, when they're discussing the different classifications of the amplifier, at least in its most basic description, they don't bother explaining, you know, if the most efficient design is a Class C, then it would make sense that why aren't all amplifiers Class C or even better, Class D, which is even more efficient. They don't focus on the secondary aspects of it. They just go to the very simplified version of this is what A, B, B, and C mean. And, you know, next month when you take amplifier theory, they'll get into the harmonics, the noises, and how to build filters and all.
I had a really fun trip up the Empire State Building, and my SBE 15 Society of Broadcast Engineers had some techs that work up there on top, and we went up and looked at the filter combiners and stuff like that that they have for all the transmitters into the antenna up there. And it's quite an installation up there on top. We had a lovely afternoon.
It's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, all these places, if you can look into the guts of them, are fascinating. You know, the outside just is a bunch of buttons, dials, you know, meters and such. But the inner aspects of it, you know, in the old days, there were people who actually even kind of walked in to a, you know, the massive AM broadcast transmitters were big enough that when the power was off, you could climb into them.
I think that also the Tesla photograph was actually a double exposure, too. You know, I don't think he was sitting in there.
I hope he wasn't. He was a little bit on the crazy side, and he got worse as time went on. And unfortunately, you know, before he died, he had an interview. He lived in a hotel, and he mentioned that one of the pigeons who nested outside his windowsill was his wife.
I didn't know he was married to the pigeons, but I do know that, he did live in the New Yorker Hotel, and had, the room had to be divisible by three, and I knew he took care of the pigeons, but I didn't know he married one. That's a new fact for me, Roy.
I assume it was a common law marriage, but I didn't read any of the details. Brilliant man, but brilliant men are capable of, they're fragile sometimes, and I think he broke.
He certainly didn't get the support he needed during his lifetime. Just think if he was actually able to do that, you know, with the Wardenclyffe Tower. I mean, maybe he actually would have created some kind of harmonic in the ionosphere. I don't know if anybody's really looked into that, but it seems like there's a lot of Tesla societies out there, and the museum is out there, but I don't know if we could ever do what he was thinking of and still maintain the rest of our digital era. I think there would be too much interference.
Unfortunately, his logic was very faulty towards the end. He was vociferously against Einstein. He thought relativity was nonsense, and he believed that he had detected a particle that traveled faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. And being a humble man, he was going to call it a Tesla after himself. Years later, people kind of backtracked and figured out that if he actually did see any particle, it was probably a neutrino. They don't travel faster than the speed of light. There are still people trying to sell perpetual motion machines. There was a company in Texas that built a knockoff of a Tesla tower. They went bankrupt. There are forums out there. There's a gentleman who's a regular on my TechNet over at Limark who has been looking into the field of over-unity energy and Tesla coils for at least 12 years that I know of.
So the concept that these guys are working on is the Tesla coil goes to over-unity energy, just like this last fusion experiment that they did, it goes over-unity?
Would not honor them with a similarity to the fusion reactions. The fusion reactions didn't go over unity. What the fusion reactions did simply was that you were able to produce more energy than you had to put in to start the chain reaction, which is a different thing entirely. There's kind of two things that Tesla people are fixated on. One is an over unity device. A lot of times you'll see YouTubes where people sort of seem to plug the output of an outlet back into itself, and they suggest to you that the energy just keeps going round and round and builds up, and you can tap it and it's next to free. And then there are other people who are more interested in Tesla's theories that don't really work about moving energy from one place to another without attenuation losses. Electromagnetic waves have an inverse square law. You can't really go around them. You can to a degree if you provide a waveguide, but waveguides are expensive and they don't. You can't really keep and maintain their function over a long distance, and there are some people who think that the Earth can be a waveguide when I see no reason why it can't. It's not uniform the way that most waveguides are, and so it fails at multiple points and is not really feasible. And I personally wouldn't want to sit around near a high-energy electromagnetic field ripping through my body. Electromagnetic waves in a non-ionizing range will not kill you by destroying your cells, but they do heat things up. So it would be like living in a microwave oven, which, again, I don't think I'd like.
And all of that makes me wonder about these space-based solar arrays that are supposedly beaming energy down to Earth. It doesn't seem like that's that efficient, and the target area must be quite wide, for them to be able to do that. Do you have a take on that?
At this point, they're not practical. They're experimental, and usually the area where they beam the energy down to is someplace in the middle of the desert where they can't fry anything but, say, the occasional cactus or iguana.
Wanton sacrifice of whatever desert fauna we have is not necessarily worth the energy or the effort. I think all these guys lifting all this stuff into space, maybe we should think twice about that and try to uplift our other populations on the Earth. You know, that would be a good idea. Nobody would be starving.
Not quite sure what you mean by uplifting. If you mean placing people above the Earth, that's going to be very expensive to do, very expensive to maintain, and very easy to screw up. We have more than enough surface area, and if progress continues with fusion reactors, we might have a reasonably safe source for a lot of energy with no radioactive waste and the other problems that fusion reactions give us. So I think it's much more feasible to go for these types of energy devices than to lift people on space stations. Makes for good science fiction, but in the real world, again, it's not terribly cost effective. If you ever looked at anyone who actually did the math on Elon Musk's nonsensical Mars colony, the guy's delusional, or at least he doesn't know how to multiply and divide, because the amount of money it would take to lift off the resources required to build all kinds of industrial things on the surface of Mars, plus the fact that astronauts, after almost a year of traveling in zero gravity, are going to be weak as newborn puppies. So, I think the new story about fission, fusion rather, is much better than anything else I've heard.
Well, I think the other half of the trip to Mars is the shielding from the cosmic rays. So there's all these problems that maybe we can get to the moon and do that. But for longer trips, it seems like, from what I've read, it's very difficult.
I mean, there are an endless number of problems. As you mentioned, you have a significant higher exposure to cosmic rays traveling all the way to Mars. Theoretically, you could shield the ship, but if you shield the ship, it increases the mass of the ship, and it increases the requirements of the rockets to be more powerful, and it becomes a never-ending, trying to puzzle it, and it almost never works. But, I mean, there's all kinds of other problems. Human beings are not designed to exist for long periods of time in zero gravity. Just living in the space station above us, there are changes to vision and bone density and muscle mass and all kinds of things. So there's about 10 trillion problems with sending, more than one or two people to Mars. It's going to be more cost-effective to send automated systems, at the very most glorified robots. And I don't see human beings going there anytime too soon unless they're suicidal.
Well, we I think we have some suicidal people within the society that might want to give it a shot. Who knows? The astronauts did actually fly up in those first Apollo capsules and stuff, and the Challenger, and if you've ever seen those things, they're kind of amazing that they flew.
They take risks. They kind of are adrenaline junkies to begin with. They made their name before rocket ships flying experimental planes, which were dangerous. So people are willing to take risks. Most sane people are not really willing to be suicidal. And I think government agencies and politics frown on that. As nice as it is to say that our countrymen were the first to land on Mars, I don't think they'd want to also announce that our countrymen were the first people to die on Mars. And pretty much anyone who gets there is probably going to end up dying. Because, again, getting it back, the idea that that Elon Musk had was that they would make the fuel there. And again, if you do a pencil and the back of the envelope calculations, that's almost incredibly ridiculous. No one's going to be able to produce enough rocket fuel, just kind of hanging out in almost a negligible atmosphere on Mars, where if your spacesuit gets a hole in it, you'll probably die within minutes.
I read this Heinlein science fiction thing where they had these giant machines out on Mars that were converting dirt and everything else in Mars into atmosphere and pumping out oxygen and carbon and water and stuff, just from shoveling dirt and sucking air through these giant machines. But it sounds like we haven't invented those machines yet, and it's going to be a long time before they come online.
Worse than that, the ultimate question is, how do you build the damn machines? The machines are very heavy, so do you put them in massive rockets that we don't know how to make? Or Elon would tell you that, well, you'll make it on Mars. And you say, how are you going to make it on Mars? And they say, well, you'll mine. And they say, how do you mine without machines? So it becomes a kind of redundant problem there. So you can't just kind of slowly build industry in a world that's so desolate and dangerous. One stupid move and you're dead. Most people, thankfully, on the Earth are capable of doing millions of stupid things a day and surviving.
On the topic of cosmic radiation, is the moon sufficiently close enough to Earth to still give shielding from cosmic radiation?
Well, the thing that shields the Earth from most of its cosmic radiation is the atmosphere and our magnetic field.
Considered close enough to our own magnetic field to be shielded from the cosmic radiation, or is it basically the same thing as going to Mars?
It's sort of the same thing as going to Mars, except the amount of exposure, because the duration of the travel is much shorter. So, it's the duration that counts. So you can go to the moon in a week, you could go to Mars in a year. So that's where the difference in exposure comes.
Okay, I seem to be having an audio issue. I'm not sure if it's on my end or your end. Every 30 seconds or so, it gives a short cutout, for a millisecond or something like that.
I don't know what to tell you. It's possible the repeater kind of hiccups every so often. I can't hear my own signal, so I don't know. I mean, usually I'm going through computer circuits and all kinds of things. Right now I'm just going through my FDM 400, so I don't know what to tell you.
Okay, that aside, another thing I was wondering about was the remote beaming of energy that the other fellow was talking about. I didn't catch his name. Would it be possible to effectively focus RF into sort of like a laser beam, like we do with lasers?
You could have a coherent stream of radio wave energy in the same way. They're all electromagnetic waves, so be they RF or visible light or ultraviolet light, you can all arrange them in the same sort of phase-aligned way. And there are machines that do that. Microwave lasers exist.
I remember reading about some sort of anti-riot device they have that sort of blasts like some sort of microwave or something, and people feel like a burning sensation if they enter that like force field or like the area that they calibrated to.
There's a lot of riot weapons that are supposedly non-lethal, involving both ultrasound, which can make people nauseous and give them headaches and cause other problems, and microwave energy, which heats up their heads and causes discomfort as well. There was a rumor back about 3-4 years ago that Cuba had some kind of secret weapon and they were attacking our diplomats, and then all of a sudden it was going on in China, and all of a sudden it was going on someplace in Europe, and to this day no one has any proof of that, and some people like myself think it's a degree of hysteria, which isn't to say that these people were crazy at all, but human beings are capable of having hysterical attacks. They're well documented many, many, many times. But they do work on they're supposed to be weapons that don't cause long-term harm, but no one's really done enough research to prove that fact.
Okay, and if they do have weapons that cause no lethal harm, the question is, what's stopping them from developing a weapon that can actually microwave someone's eyeballs or brains from, let's say, 100 feet using a focused microwave?
I guess ultimately it's a lot cheaper to just use a bullet.
So, but the advantages would be enormous to have something that goes in a straight line without all the ballistics issues, and also, I guess, unlimited ammo as long as you have a power source.
It's a big if. No one has an unlimited power source. So that's the problem. One of the problems. The problem is a microwave generator that produces that much power. Microwaves are not the most efficient transmitters in the world, so they're very inefficient. They require a great deal of power. They take up a great deal of space for any significant power. So you have something that has to supply power. You have another thing that has to use the power. And like I said, you get a rifle with a gun sight and a bullet, and you basically accomplish the same thing. People have been shooting other people for, 300, 400 years. Everyone sort of knows what the velocity of a bullet dropping down is, and there are sights that correct for that. So, it's kind of like reinventing the wheel, except that the wheel has to be 5,000 times bigger and made of gold.
Okay, I like that. I like that metaphor. Another question would be, so if it's not the most efficient, would it be possible to, let's say you have a base or something that you must defend at all costs, and you mount one of these on some sort of rotating motor,
necessarily. You have, if it's really expensive and you have one of them, you can only point them in one direction at a time, and it takes a non-zero amount of time to reset it for a different location. It's probably, again, much cheaper to have a lot of cheap, simple weapons than a Death Star.
Okay, I'm just letting my imagination run wild.
Well, it's useful. I mean, that's how people kind of figure out the good and the bad of any kind of idea. So there's a lot of ideas. Unfortunately, I find that there's a lot of solutions in search of a problem. A cryptocurrency being a prime example. The only thing that I could see that cryptocurrency is excellent at is stealing money from people, and it's doing it rather well. But all the other claims don't seem to be working out too well.
I agree with you on that one.
I mean, unfortunately, a year ago, there were a lot more people who were very eager to hand over their money to cryptocurrency types of people. You know, then there was non-fungible tokens. God knows how many billions of dollars were lost in that.
That was a big fiasco.
And it will not end with this guy from FTX. There will be other exchanges that collapse under their own weight. I think all of them will ultimately collapse under their own weight.
Yeah, I agree with you. I had another question from earlier when you guys were discussing the people going to the moon. They do, I know, have an issue with the far side of the moon because no radio waves from Earth could reach the far side of the moon without any intermediate satellite or something like that. Is it that hard to make some small repeater with like solar power and just have it orbit the moon or lunar stationary orbit, something like that?
Theoretically, it's not impossible. It's not very difficult, but it's an additional step that they have to make if they're going to do anything on the far side of the moon. You know, and they already have a whole bunch of steps that they have to do in general. So an additional one of building, you know, no one's ever built a satellite long term persisted. Circling the moon, so it's another thing that they have to do research, development, and pay a lot of people to manufacture.
Would you think it's feasible if they do say they're trying to establish the lunar colony on whatever they want to call it, on the south pole of the moon, would a large antenna there be able to propagate signals to like the far side of the moon and beyond, to let's say to the outer solar system, being that it's on the pole of the moon, which generally I guess could see Earth and to the outer solar system?
Well, you got to keep in mind why propagation works on the Earth. It works on the Earth because we have an ionosphere. We have an ionosphere because we have an atmosphere. The moon doesn't have an atmosphere. It doesn't have an ionosphere. And so it doesn't have skywave propagation. The only thing that's going to work is point-to-point communication and ground wave propagation. So you're not going to really get an Earth-like propagation case on the moon.
Yeah, that's true. I guess if I was on the far side of the moon, the polar antenna on one of the poles would not help me. But let's say I was to travel far beyond the moon, let's say to near Jupiter, would that antenna be able to transmit to me and to Earth?
It transmit to you? As far as I'm aware, yes. I guess it really depends upon the orbits and such, because there'll be times that things are blocked. But then you have a problem that you need a very, very, very powerful sensitive big receiving station. The receiving stations that we have in on the Earth are not things that are put up on people's roofs like our antennas. They're rather massive, sophisticated devices to be able to pick up the weak signals of satellites and such that we've sent out towards the end of the solar system. So whether we would have the base stations with large receiving antennas in locations that would be able to pick up the signal would be another engineering problem. It could be assessed. It could be, you know, you could do it with enough money and enough time. The question is, would people be willing to do it, take all that time and that money to make it happen?
Okay. I guess that's all for now. Thank you very much. I'll be listening on.
Okay, very good, Michael. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. And I'm hearing very strange signals, so I don't know. That's very odd. I don't know. Something weird is happening.
This is AC2ZV, maybe I turned the transmit on to fast, but I'm checking in with you via Echo Link, so it's getting a little late for me, so I just wanted to thank you for all your comments tonight, Roy.
Okay, very good. It's probably you were going through the Echo Link, and it's really not set up for the Echo Link because of that problem that I mentioned. But okay, so that explains why the output was a little bit wonky for a little while. Well, before we close it for tonight, which I think we're going to be doing any minute from now, if anyone has any closing comments to make about this particular technical net, feel free. Hit the push to talk and say your piece. Well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be January 4th, which will be held by teleconference primarily. We're going to be hopefully trying out the hybrid meeting over at Williams Place, and you can see that discussed on the front page of our website. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. We do not accept anonymous requests. Although our meeting informally begins after 7 p.m., our formal general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly two-meter net every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. And we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m., usually on 28.380. But if that frequency is being used by someone, we move over to the right or to the left. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RFC repeater on the Internet as well as our 10-meter net at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. To everyone, what's coming up is Christmas and such. We will be back here after Christmas, because we'll be back on the 28th. But everyone out there, have a great Christmas. If you celebrate Chanukah, have a great Chanukah. Stay safe and be well. And please come back and join us when we come back to do this all over again. So this is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. And I am almost clear. Okay, very good. So, Bob, if you can email me a copy of that WAV file, I really would appreciate it.